My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. Today, I'm talking with Ryan Palmer, and Ryan, I'll let you introduce yourself, kind of talk about the age level that you work with and the type of setting that you work in.
Absolutely. So, as Shredda said, my name is Ryan Palmer. I'm going into my third year as a nationally certified school psychologist, working elementary level. So I have two buildings. Each building has approximately 450 students. One building serves K through five, and the other is adding a pre-K room. So we'll have pre-K to five there. Both buildings also have an integrated behavioral and academic ILC, as well as support from our countywide programs. They kind of have like their own classrooms in each grade band. But unfortunately, I don't really work with that. Our countywide program is very particular about working with their own students and staff.
Talk about your career journey a little bit, kind of how you got to the point you're at now.
So I had no idea I wanted to be in education broadly until I started substitute teaching once I turned 18. Having opportunities to substitute teach and be a substitute paraprofessional, like a one-on-one situation for a student, it kind of opened my world to special education because I had a very limited understanding of special ed at the time. It was very, if there were visible disabilities, that's kind of my understanding of what special ed was when I finished high school. So working with students with the invisible disabilities, our OHI, our LD students, and seeing what that entailed, I really fell in love with education and special ed. So as a psych major in undergrad, I went out for Teach for America, once as a junior, once as a senior. I was an ambassador on campus for University of Delaware, really believed in it. And even when I didn't get it, I still wanted to go into education. So the advisors at UD helped me apply for the school psychology program, kind of as like a reach program. So I was very thankful, very fortunate to get into it. Through that program, I was managing undiagnosed ADHD, which I didn't recognize until we had that moment. In our intro classes when we were going over the disability categories, and I was like checking my own boxes, which I know as a practitioner we're never supposed to do, but it was so eye-opening that I couldn't help myself. Like, wow, this is inattentive ADHD is really descriptive for me. So after a while, I eventually got to a doctor and got that handled after my second internship. My first internship, I quit about 800 hours in to the 1,200-hour program with the first district I was in for lengthy time. I couldn't handle the amount of paperwork I was doing compared to the amount of actual work I was doing with students. And I think that is, I think that's a pretty common pretty common feedback I hear from a lot of my practitioner friends and even from my professors after the fact. So I quit for the paperwork, left to go work with a family therapy agency. If we're thinking like in models as far as like MTSS or like an RTI model, this agency functioned as like tier three for intensive mental health care. So the clients I had, I only have like five or six at a time. They were either stepping down from, like an inpatient mental health facility, or they were essentially, we were the stopgap before, the state of Delaware intervened and either enter the children in foster care or place them in residential facilities outside of the state. So that was a pretty big sell for me to get myself into that agency without like a family therapy background or mental health background. But the model the agency used, ecosystemic structural family therapy, was developed by Marion Lindblad Goldberg, who was B.F. Skinner's assistant. So a lot of the model that we used was actually very behaviorally based, and I had a really good behavior background coming from school psychology, so it worked out.
It's interesting that we knew that about his assistant.
Everything about the therapy model we used analyzed mental health within the context of not only the familial system, but in the context of the community at large. We had all the microsystems we intervened with, but we also had to essentially do therapy within the macro environment for these families. So like, we had like celebrations when we could, after 5, 6 months of really intensive in-home and school and community therapy, like take a family to like Walmart or take them out for a meal, and there not be like a blow up or police called or our typical the end of our typical pattern. So it was really intense, and it was really eye-opening because to that point trauma, abstract trauma was not abstract to me. It was an acute occurrence that required an immediate acute response with potential for long-term follow-up. But I didn't really understand what trauma looked like in a system. So this really showed me. I mean, I worked, my caseload took me from, $2 million homes in Bethany Beach to, Section 8 housing up in Wilmington. And trauma impacted all these families indiscriminately. Granted, there are systemic barriers and the privilege that comes along with, the intersectionality of how these families identified and how my clients identified, and that all had its impact, of course. But as far as the actual impact on the kids, it was just so eye-opening. So I recognized at the time, I think it was around September, school year had already started off, and I realized, I wanted to try to make a bigger impact than the 5 or 6 families I could work with at a time, and I wanted to return to school psychology with this better understanding and kind of with a drive to prepare staff, prepare families, prepare students to be able to understand their trauma and their history and how it plays out currently. I think I sometimes come off as jaded to my staff because they can describe to me like a behavioral escalation, and how difficult a student was when they like break a pencil or refuse an assignment and push it off their desk, and like it takes me to probably the scariest individual moment of my life was when I was still working with this agency. I was working with an older client. He's about 17, 16, and he was kind of in and out of juvenile detention. At the time, I didn't have a partner to implement the model with, so I was by myself with the session. Essentially, the mother involved didn't listen to my professional recommendation of not further escalating her son. And she made that one last comment to him while he was calming down by himself in his room, and he exploded. And when I say destroyed a kitchen, I mean I've never seen how much force it takes to split a wooden countertop in half, but I know what it looks like.
Wow.
And then Then he grabbed a knife and was threatening himself and then me with it. It took about 20, 30 minutes of him with his knife before his older brother and I could de-escalate him. Even once he was de-escalated, and as we would in our education system, return to class or he's ready to start working again. His breathing was calmed. He wasn't visibly agitated. Just quiet. Although he was, again, quote unquote, ready to return to do the work, to do therapy. He still wanted to play out this, and attempted to play out this death by cop fantasy he had. So the mom called police, and police arrived, and and he was sitting out front. And he took his shirt off, and he still had his knife. And he, we warned the officers ahead of time, so they luckily were able to de-escalate him and handle him
Right.
and get him to a hospital. But that was scary. It was really powerless, like that feeling of powerless. Like I understand, when a student or when a child is over the top like that, I understand that powerless feeling, when you just can't get them to stop. I think like that's obviously a pretty extreme example. But I try to hold on to that a lot for my work in schools because a lot of times I imagine that's what, a teacher or a parent or an admin feels like when just nothing is working. And it has to be scary like that. Anyway, sorry, that was tangent.
No, that was really interesting to hear, and it kind of made me think about, as you're talking about that experience and trauma and working at the macro level. There's, of course, we talk as educators a lot about vicarious trauma, right? And I'm wondering how or what you took from those experiences that helped you learn how to take care of yourself and help staff take care of themselves, in schools when they're dealing with that kind of trauma.
Well, I mean, I, you know, every year, around that anniversary of just that event for myself, like I feel it. I feel that fear. I remember that night, I guess that day working with that client. And then I try to use that in a compassionate and empathetic way. I tell teachers a lot, for the last 2 months that our student has been in the process of getting, intervention or counseling or outside counseling or a referral. They still have to come and teach that student. They still have to come and work with that student and endure, whatever that student is throwing at them to push that boundary and figure out like where are the hard lines in this setting. And that's traumatizing. That's very difficult for staff to navigate, especially staff who may not have as robust of a mental health or behavioral health background that school psychs do. So I try to validate those feelings of re-traumatization. Try to validate those feelings of even just that vicarious trauma that can affect them later or could affect the students in the room, or students close to a more primarily affected student. And it's hit or miss. We have staff that we work with who are very receptive to trying to understand and trying to broaden that knowledge. And then we have some staff who are a little more resistant. But I think it does lead to, again, that more empathetic understanding of, what that experience must be like.
Yeah, sure.
So coming back to my second go at internship, I had a much better understanding of why I was there. I think, just almost on like a spiritual level, like understanding our why and what drives us to do this work is so necessary. Because I don't know anybody who signs up to do the amount of paperwork and day-to-day work that educators do, just in general. We definitely don't do that for the paycheck. No amount of paycheck is worth that. So we're definitely here for something something more substantial than that. A huge influence for me finding that drive was my eventual intern supervisor, Dr. Tawanda Morgan. Just absolutely phenomenal supervisor, phenomenal psychologist. I would not have made it here without her. And equally thankful for my professors with University of Delaware. Marika, I'm sorry, Dr. Ginsburg Block and Dr. George Bear. I also got to train under Kathy Minke before she left for her role with NASP full time.
Right.
So all of them have been just so supportive and so influential. I mean, they're supportive of my, sad but supportive of my decision to leave the field, and then, equally supportive to get me back in and help me finish out my training properly. But yeah, so coming into my first full year of school psych and now my second year, so much of my focus is on staff readiness. Between both of my buildings, I have two or three kids that, and I think we all have this experience as practitioners where we have two or three kids that could just eat up every single one of our days, every day. It's always the student that, the teachers have feel like they have the need to warn us about, or we hear the stories about the kid before we meet them, and then I'm always really disappointed because at the end of the day they're still just like 9 and confused about like what life is and just really needing to be heard. They're never as scary as the campfire stories make them out to be. I think like a big just a big recognition piece for me that I am very thankful for. At the end of my first year, some psychs in my district nominated me, and I won Passionate Champion Award from the governor's office.
Oh, nice.
For my advocacy, for my staff readiness and push for integration of trauma-informed care within MTSS.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
So talk a little bit more about staff readiness, because when I hear that makes me think you're working on a larger scale. You're working still with those individual students, but then you're also having to work with administrators, work with other leaders in the district and in your buildings for getting your staff ready to address some of these behaviors and kind of see them in a different way.
Yeah, so I think I struggle to think of the of an educator who is malicious by intent. I think when there are misfirings in communication, misunderstandings in behavioral expression, and the cause of behavior, I think that's where we get that student teacher conflict or that conflict between teachers and ourselves. So I feel like, again, like coming back on this drive and platform to expand, trauma knowledge, to expand trauma-informed care techniques. So much for that for me is, standing in front of, the buildings that I work in, and as many times as I can, as many times as my administrators will let me talk about behavior and trauma and disability. I do it. I take every opportunity I can. I beg for, 20 minutes in a staff meeting to talk about, some kind of technique that is going to improve practice. I think of what my scope is. Primarily, it's assessment. Primarily, my duty is to evaluate my students. And since my caseload's a little larger than my other elementary psychs that I work with, I don't necessarily always have the time to work individually with the students who need my help the most, to the extent that I want. So I try to instead spend my time when I have some time, trying to impact, again, the system as a whole, trying to impact educator practice. If I can help improve one teacher's practice in a whole building, that's 25 kids they work with that year. That's another 25 kids the year after, and so on. I just like I beg for opportunities in my buildings, I am similarly annoying at the district level to try to offer, beginning of year trainings, mid-year trainings. I have no problem taking some work home over the weekend to get a half a day on Friday to go to a different building or a different district and give training. I think I am so annoying about offering trainings. DSEA, our teacher union, our educator union, gave me a part-time position as a trainer for the state. So I do, it's kind of a new thing with DSEA, but I am, available to travel to schools, to districts, to give various trainings on trauma-informed care, on disability studies, on restorative practices, self-care techniques, all those things that go into the whole educator.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I love that DSEA recognized that as a need and then took up a school psychologist for that cause. And I also love that you talk about, as many times as you can, you're begging for those 20 minutes of the staff meeting or being as annoying as possible to give trainings at the district level. I love that because I think a lot of times school psychologists tend to struggle with that part of it, the systems part or that macro part of our jobs. Put us in a room with a student who may be throwing a few chairs and we're golden, but ask us to talk to our district leaders and really advocate for our roles going beyond that assessment piece. That's actually really difficult, I'm finding, for a lot of us, and for many different reasons. I think a lot of people are afraid straining relationships, and being perceived a certain way, maybe perceiving that's not agreeable all the time. So, how do you balance that? Is that something that worries you even? Is that something that you've had to deal with?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you can advocate for great change at a systems level without pissing some people off, honestly. I was having this conversation with one of my new administrators a couple weeks ago. He's new to the building, and he and I were talking about systems level work. And he told me that a system works exactly as intended, and that you get the outcomes that you intend to get from the beginning based on the design. If you're not getting the outcomes you want, then you've designed your system poorly. And that's really just resonated with me the last couple of weeks, and it makes so much sense. And even prior to that, I just have to think, like, I'm still incredibly uncomfortable talking in front of a room, talking in front of district office staff. That's kind of like my biggest secret, is that I'm never comfortable doing it. It's just I know that at the end of the day, it's my duty to do it because my duty is to my students. And if I have a system that is supposed to be supporting my students but is not doing its job, then I know the system is poorly designed, and I need to use my expertise and use my knowledge to help design a better system. As far as maintaining the relationships, and having so many of these conversations with district office staff and different staff from other districts, even, everybody within education speaks a slightly different language. I love the meetings I have when I'm talking about, MTSS implementation, and halfway through, a building admin or a teacher stops me and asks me to slow down or define an acronym or re-explain that in a different way. And because one, it tells me they're listening, but two, it gives me an understanding of where are the gaps in that language between stakeholders in our system. So I end up asking my admin a lot of questions about budgeting, because I know next to nothing about budgeting, but I always get confused when it's like, hey, I really need a test kit, but I don't have the money for that test kit. Well, why don't I? This is for our students. I need that money.
Right.
It's figuring out that language. It's figuring out what everyone's different goals and priorities are. And then I think because of our training as psychologists, as school psychologists, we kind of exist in this really unique space to bridge all of those different stakeholder groups. And we can do it in a way that is so goal-driven and priority-driven that even when I don't necessarily see eye to eye with an administrator or a teacher leader or another stakeholder, at the end of the day, we're still here for the kids. We can always bring the conversation back to, well, what's best for students? And that has gone so far in bridging that. Even when I drive home after a challenging day of work, challenging adults, never challenging kids, I still just have to remind myself, like, this is what they think is best for the students right now. It's not my job necessarily to fight against that. It's my job to find where is that compromise and can I help that other stakeholder? How can I help them get to a level of understanding that I have? And how can they help me get to their level of understanding? How can I understand better where they're coming from and why they want what they want?
I like that. That's a really good suggestion for those struggling with those types of dynamics. And I appreciate that it's really using the counseling skills and our own empathy that we already have and applying it to those situations.
It's helpful to, I think, always bring it back to the kids also just brings a level of honesty and transparency to it. I don't want anyone I work with to think I'm disingenuous. Like, I want them to always know where I stand on an issue or on a topic. And even if that can be blunt or unexpected, because I think a lot of us are very good at kind of dancing around our advocacy, even our
Right.
self-advocacy. I think administrators adjust to it really quickly. The ones that I've worked with who have embraced this style, they understand the value of that 5-minute hallway chat, right? So much work gets done in those 5 minutes between classes, or that, calling down your principal and saying like, "Oh, where are you going? I'll walk with you. I had an idea." Once you can kind of build that rapport with them, to have those talks frequently, and where they know that you're not coming to, sell them on a 2-hour pitch, it feels like a lot more gets done.
You talked about some defining moments in your career. What are some of the most difficult challenges you've faced in your career? How have you handled those challenges?
I think every time I feel like I have failed a student, it seems to be because I don't have the time to devote to them. As an early career psych, I still struggle with balancing caseloads. Even if I can work with a student, a few days a week, and even if I have in my head, okay, like here's my step by step of getting them where they need to be to, stay in the setting or to, hit their educational potentials. I don't think I've ever been in a setting where I've had the time to really work with that kid and get them there. So anytime I have like a change of setting meeting, or even just a principal brings up, is this the right place for the student? I really struggle with that because the idealistic practitioner in me says, of course, this is the right school for this kid. This school is the right place for every kid. Like, we want to make a school that meets the educational needs of every learner and every brain that walks through those doors. And then there's I don't want to say the pragmatic part of me, but almost the more pragmatic part of me says, yeah, with 900 students and four ILC classrooms between two buildings, like, I don't necessarily have the time to get this kid to where they need to be.
Right.
And judging by, where the proposed setting is, like, I know the staff there can. It hurts every time to admit that. I think it's healthy to be able to admit when, especially in the best interest of a student, when my skill set's not enough, or when the logistics of my job don't allow my skill set to be enough. But it's still hard. It's still, we never want to feel like we're failing our students, especially our most vulnerable and most needy. And, these are our kids that we are eating lunch with 2 or 3 days a week, that we're, coaching in the room and, counseling and talking with 2 or 3 days a week anyway. So, I think it especially hurts, to feel, like I'm not enough to support them or to help them.
Yeah, I
I think
imagine
good.
school psychologists all over who might be listening to this are nodding vehemently in agreement. Seems like a commonality amongst all of us.
I'd say so. Yeah, I think, I mean, ultimately, I know I've said caseload a few times, and I know for every psych I know who has a better caseload, I know two more who have worse caseloads. I think, the district I'm with is moving in a better direction for managing individual caseloads. I think we could definitely talk a whole another episode just on addressing the school psych shortage in the state and in the country. But yeah, that is such a factor. My one of my old building principals, who I've gotten to kind of keep in touch with, and he was really influential on myself and another of my mentors. He always referred to school psychologists as an inch deep but a mile wide, with our duties.
Right.
And oh my God, does that that hits home.
That's very
That,
accurate.
yeah, it is. And his where he's at now, this administrator, his whole approach is hire every school psych who is interested in working for me, because even if we don't have a building to put them in right now to themselves, we'll find a job for them at district office, or we'll find a role for them somewhere, because again, we have such a broad skill set and a broad application of that. I think some people get it. I think a lot of administrators are still getting there. It helps now that sometimes when I go to new buildings, I'll have administrators come to me and say, "Tell me what your job is," which is huge. Like, I love it when they don't know what I do, because then I can actually tell them, this is what I actually end up doing. This is what I'm trained to do, what I'm supposed to do. Help me get there." And they want to. They're like, "Wow, that sounds great. Let's see what we can do about that."
Nice. So you are now in, you said, the third year of your career, and you describe yourself as an early career school psychologist. What advice would you give to other early career school psychologists, those coming into the field or in their first or second year?
So I've caught myself, the first like month I'm in a new building, I asset map. I talk with my administrators. I talk with teacher leaders, not necessarily lead teachers, but teacher leaders. If there are like teacher coaches available, or one district I was in had like achievement liaison teachers who like managed, again, like helped like mentor new teachers, and had that that leadership role, and just figure out what is in place in my building. How does everything fit into MTSS? What supports are available? What are my gaps? And then just set goals around those gaps. Again, taking that systems level perspective in your building or in your district, to figure out where your energy is best spent. I could make a whole career just trying to better define math MTSS in my district. I could do that now until I retire. But my energy is probably not best spent there, considering we have math specialists in district office and we have them in every building. I'm going to leave it up to the math specialist to figure that out. I'm just going to help provide that, again, that system's guidance. Now that we have that figured out, what does it look like on a whole district level? So again, figuring out what gaps there are and what's reasonable in our position with our voice, platform, privilege, power to affect that. The second step to that, which I know is gonna fall on a lot of deaf ears, but just stop saying yes to everything. There's the look on someone's face when the school psych says no, like it's priceless. And I don't just mean that like in a wanton, like I don't feel like it way. But again, once you asset map and once you define what the gaps are, and once you share those gaps with with the stakeholders, with the teacher leaders, with the admin, and you say, this is my plan. This is how I want to help this. Suddenly you have an anchor to say no to. Sorry, I can't do that. I don't see, like, I don't have the time for that. I'm already working towards this. You remember when we talked about this a couple months ago? Okay, like that's where my time is right now. I'm sorry I can't do that right now. And then sometimes, like when you know you've hit that limit, and if you even just don't have a good excuse, you can just say no. You can just say no, I'm sorry. You don't need a reason. It's and that's so hard. That is the hardest thing. Especially early career, we want to be seen as that resource. We want to be utilized. We don't want to just be test and place machines, most of us. But again, finding that boundary and finding, how you're going to best spend your energy. Once you fix those gaps and fix those issues, like your administrators notice and your teachers notice, and they recognize, like, hey, like I'm not just going to drop an extra hour of, lunch duty on my psychologist. That hour is better spent elsewhere. So it's that long game, right? It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a lot of time. And you are going to have some awkward interactions when you're not agreeing to everything. But just recognizing that it's towards a plan, it's towards something bigger than that moment, makes it okay after.
And I'm wondering how it would have shaped my early career years if someone had told me that in graduate school. Don't say yes to everything and do asset mapping and really explain in detail what that means. So I'm going to kind of extend my question. What advice would you give to graduate programs? Would you tell them to teach their students the same thing or anything else?
I mean, definitely, yeah, I had like one night of class on asset mapping. And it really stuck with me. I was like, wow, this seems like an answer for me, 2 years from now. Not everyone that I graduated with or worked with did. I think, emphasizing that, because again, if the profession wants to move away from test in place, then the profession in the training programs needs to embrace how to operate within a system. Kind of going off of that, having staff training, being able to train prospective school psychologists in how to live professional development, how to navigate those relationships with adults, how to speak in front of your staff, in an effective way, how to, take that educational language that we utilize and utilize accessible. It's so easy for us to just get overloaded in jargon, because us within our field, like, I know I'm never going to sound as smart as half the psychs I work with, but boy, howdy, I want to make my writing look like I am. So I'm going to do what I can to make my writing look like I'm a bit more capable than I am. When I'm working with my staff, though, that doesn't necessarily translate. And my school psych jargon means literally nothing, to most of the adults I work with. So, I wish I had more preparation in delivering that. I think that's like such a powerful and underutilized role of the school psychologist, is that staff readiness. And I think those skills just transition so naturally into systems level work. So again, if you can bridge the stakeholder groups and understand how to effectively use the language that we have and the knowledge from all these different subfields, I think it puts us in a really, really useful position, really, utilitarian position in our districts.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping that as the field continues to evolve, that more graduate programs will start to embed some of those skills in their courses. On that note,
Absolutely.
I want to say thank you so much for your time. This has been really insightful, and thank you for sharing your experiences.
Absolutely. This is my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening to the Leitner side of things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.